Last time we finished up with looking at the decline of the Roman Catholic Church leading up to the time of the Reformation, beginning 200, 300 years before the event itself. And there's definitely some decline going on. And there were some attempts within the church to reform the church. We looked at that. We looked at Wycliffe and Huss and Savonarola. And at least Huss and Wycliffe were attempting to theologically deal with issues within the church. They also had some other things they were working on as well, trying to get the clergy to actually live up to their faith and to stop corruption in the church. But they were also very interested in theological matters, that you could not sell indulgences, you could not buy your way to the kingdom of God, and other things that needed reform within the church. But there were other efforts within the church to reform it. And these were more dealing with, we talked about, the splits in the church, the two schisms that were going on, that there are church councils that were trying to deal with those issues, to bring reform where, you wouldn't have two popes or three popes at the same time, and kind of get that back in order. So here were some of the reforms related to those efforts. Church councils, and also trying to set up a framework, trying to set up a rationale for basically firing a pope, something that just wasn't done. Today, there are labor laws that you have to follow if you're trying to fire someone so you don't get in legal trouble. Well, back then, I guess you could say in a different way, you also had issues if you were trying to fire someone. The popes felt they had rights that could not be violated. They were supposed to be in their office until the day they died, and they knew it, and they were not willing to give up their jobs. So two people tried to deal with this intellectually. They tried to lay out reasons, rationales for how it is that you could remove a pope. So the first work that we will look at just briefly was written by Dante. This would be the same Dante who wrote the Divine Comedy. He wrote other things as well. And actually, if you read the Divine Comedy, and I have, actually, Cooley said this was her project at the moment. She's been trying to read through this. I also got some lectures on my iPhone. You kind of need it. Unless you know 14th century Italian history really well. But regardless, if you read Divine Comedy, there is no sharper critic of the popes during his era than Dante himself. He realizes the church needs reform. It needs reform morally, and it needs reform as an institution. But Dante was trying to deal with this issue. How exactly do you fire a pope? Well, in this book on monarchy, he wrote that there were two important institutions in the world. The first were, your kings, the government. And their job in the big picture was to look after your happiness on earth. They're supposed to bring law and order. They are supposed to make sure people don't starve. They are supposed to make sure if there is a war that the state is defended, all of those things and more. They're looking after your happiness on earth, and this is all part of God's plan. The church, however, is supposed to look after your soul and your eternal salvation. Dante comes down that neither of these institutions is higher than the other. And he reasons that if one of these branches, one of these institutions is not doing its job, it's okay for the other to play a role in the removal of people from office. So he therefore says that basically kings can remove the Pope if the Pope is not doing his job. Next was this Marsilius Padua, and he wrote the book on the Defender of the Peace. And he also, just very briefly, said that really it's the people who make up the church, and the people who make up the state. And they are the people that really give the right to rule to the Pope and to the king, or queen for that matter. And the way these are elected is not by the people directly, by groups of people who represent the people. So the people who have been given that authority are the cardinals in the church's case. And if the cardinals come together as a council and decide that the Pope should not be in office, they have every right to do so. They can remove him. They're actually the ones who have the power to say whether the Pope is in office or not. So those were two of the more philosophical arguments for removing a Pope. So then they had some councils. And the first you see there is the Council of Pisa in 1409. And this was called by the cardinals. And at this time, there's a Pope in Avignon, and there is a Pope in Rome. And there is also a third Pope that is around as well, because they tried to get these two to leave, and they wouldn't leave, and this other Pope was there. Well, wait, I should back up a little bit. So first we have the Pope in Avignon, and then we have the Pope in Rome. The cardinals get together, and they say, you know what? We decide that the Pope in Avignon no longer rules. We decide the Pope in Rome no longer rules. And they decide to elect a third guy. This guy's name is Alexander V. You don't really need to know that. But they feel that as they leave this council, they've done good, send out the messengers to these other popes to tell them they're no longer in charge, and go back home thinking we've, you know, solved the problem. Well, the problem is they had not. The Pope in Avignon, the Pope in Rome received these messages, and they said, both of them say, you know what? I don't recognize you. I'm the Pope. And so they keep ruling. And this third Pope, Alexander V, says, you know what? You elected me. I'm not giving up my office either. So they've actually already, they've made the situation even worse. So they try again. There was from 1414 to 1418 a council in Constance, and this is actually the council that Hus will be burned at the stake. Some other things they did at that council. It was called by the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund. The council was attempting once again to end this great schism in the church. And it was also attempting to reform the church in other ways as well. On the first thing, they were successful. They actually, this time, did depose all three popes. And this time, the three, under extreme pressure, decided we will give up our offices. And then they got a new pope within there. So they were able to reform the church in that way, get one pope back again. Following that, there were the councils of Basel and Ferrara. And from 1431, and these lasted quite a while, 1431, 1449, as well as Florence. And at this council, the idea that councils could be higher than the Pope essentially ended. The Pope at that time was strong enough to say, you know what, maybe that was good for that crisis, but now let's go back to the old system. I'm in charge, and no one can depose me. I am the head of the church. The reforms that they attempted to put into place just did not work out. So they weren't able to make the clergy hold to any higher standards of morality or anything else. So in that way, it was a failure. And that would set up the groundwork for the Protestant Reformation of 50 or 60 years later. Now, those were all internal attempts at reform in the church. Now let's look at some external issues that were going on related to the papacy leading up to the Reformation. Various groups, councils, and a group known as humanists attempted to reform the church from inside. They would have little effect. Yet internal forces were not the only ones at work. There were also outside forces which were increasingly opposed to the papacy and putting pressure on it to change. And these three were essentially the Renaissance, the humanistic spirit of the Renaissance, nationalism, which we touched a little bit on before, and global expansion due to exploration. The Renaissance occurred in large parts of Europe between 1350 and 1650. It's considered the era in which Europe transitioned from the medieval world to a more modern world. The name itself comes from two words, birth and back. So the name implies a rebirth of culture, going back to the classical learning. The name Renaissance itself, just as an interesting piece of information, was not used for this era until the 19th century. So if you had a time machine and went back to the, say, 1600s, they would not say to you, we are in the Reformation era. I mean, in the Renaissance era, I should say. That was a term much later. The movement is often most connected with Italy, where there were rediscoveries of items from the classical world. And these would produce art and literature, a rebirth in trying to learn about those past ways of doing art and also reading the ancient classics, the ancient literature. It makes sense that it would happen in Italy. If you've been to Italy, you'll go to a museum and you will see all sorts of artifacts from the ancient world. I remember Kuli and I went to Italy a few years ago, and I remember going into a museum where they had all sorts of statues, or, you know, remains of statues, like just the head or an arm or whatever. And I remember reading, and, you know, historians are horrified by such things, that there was a time when these statue remains were all over the place. You'd find them in your yard. You'd find them, you know, you're building a, you know, building, and you dig it up, there it would be. And there were so many of them, they would grind them down to use them for construction material. And I have to say, there was a huge walkway that we went down in a museum. I mean, I don't know how many statue heads I saw. But I mean, by the time that you just see heads and arms and legs not connected together, I was thinking to myself, if I was living way back when, I might do the same thing. You know, they're just, you get a little bit tired of it. But regardless, you've got also, you know, the Colosseum, you've got the Pantheon, you've got all sorts of things all around you. So people are very interested in this. And the Renaissance would produce what were known as the humanists. The humanists. There would be two kinds of humanists. The humanists in the northern European countries would focus on religious humanism. And these humanists were interested in going back and looking at the Bible in its original languages. So they wanted to know Greek, they wanted to know Hebrew, and they wanted to, well, Latin for that matter. They wanted to know these languages, and they wanted to read scripture in its original form, or the church fathers for that matter. The southern Europeans would focus more on the study of classical literature in its original languages in Greek and Latin. So your Cicero, your Tacitus, those sort of people, they wanted to study them in their original language. Sophocles, you name it. The Renaissance was a time which saw a major shift in how people viewed themselves and also each other and even God. People previously had been more religious and focused more on community, on the group, where during this time, people became a little bit more secular. Of course, by their standards, becoming more secular, less religious, is nothing like our standards today. I'll get a little bit into that. But by their standards, it was becoming just a little more secular in what they focused on in life. And also individualistic. You're not thinking as much about the group's welfare, but what's in it for me? How do I get my will done in this world? How do I succeed, you know, by myself? The world is shifting in these ways like it had not before. And Earl Cairns, in his book, Church History Book, it tells us a little bit about how these changes were starting to happen. The medieval God-center understanding of the world, in which God was the measure of all things, gave way to the human view of life, a human-centered view of life, in which man became the measure of all things. Emphasis was placed on the glory of man instead of the glory of God. Urban, middle-class society became more important than the rural farming society of the Middle Age era. Businesses became more important than growing food as the way of making a living. A humanistic, optimistic approach to things of this life became common. Although the age clung to a religion, religion was still there, it was only as a formality on the holy days of the church. And the tendency was to forget the claims of God on an individual's life. Now, I think that Cairns is correct in to an extent that, yes, I think when you look at what we would call the elite people, you know, the top 10% of society, this would hold to be somewhat true. There was a little bit less being religious about it. There was a lot more focusing on worldly things being a business, you know, a person of business, a banker or whatever else was replacing in those circles being a farmer. But of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, even up to the 20th century, you know, the year 1900, still majority of people were farming in much of the world. The non-elite people were still very religious and so forth and so on. Not much had changed for them, but it was changing during this time of the Renaissance. I'll go to 2:30, then I'll give you a break because we kind of had a break at the beginning. There were several factors which gave rise to this Renaissance way of viewing life. Oh, I don't have those up there. First, trade between Europe and the Near East made Italian merchants wealthy. Trade between Europe and the Near East made Italian merchants wealthy. And as they had more money, they had increased time to study things that they wanted to study, because they had more free time. And they also had more money to be patrons of the arts. You know, pay Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel. Pay Leonardo da Vinci to paint the Mona Lisa. Things like that. They had time and money to do these great projects that they had not had before because of this great wealth that was coming into Italy. Also, there was increased centralization of governments, which were better able to enforce laws and keep people safer. So, as we discussed when we were going over the Middle Ages in the previous class, it was actually fairly dangerous times. You had a lot of small kingdoms. Law enforcement was not very good. It could be very dangerous traveling around. During this era, the governments are becoming stronger. They're able to have effective or more effective law enforcement. That also allowed for prosperity to flourish. Another thing is a new middle class was produced, which was interested in finding ways to make their lives more comfortable. So I remember that when Kuli and I first got married, we didn't have much money at all because we were still both students. Anything we made was pretty much going towards rent and, you know, the very basic things. But then when we graduated, both graduated and moved on, we got jobs that paid better. And then we started going shopping for furniture at some point. You know, once you get to a certain level, you're looking for things to make your life a little bit better. And with that, so these people wanted those sorts of things. It's no longer just good to have, you know, your bread on a, you know, a crummy dish. You want a nicer dish, maybe one that even looks nice. They were the same as us in that regard. And so that was another thing that made the focus of life a little bit different than it was before. There was also the invention of the printing press by Johann Gutenberg. And this made it easier and cheaper for print materials and spread ideas widely. And another thing that started to influence society was, as we discussed once again last time, the scholastic school of thought, nominalism. And if you recall, nominalism was a little more it was more interested in the individual than the society at large. It was more interested in the individual Christian than the big institution of the church. So those were all influences at this time. They were starting to bring about a change of thinking where people were becoming more secular and more individualistic.